Welcome. Thank you, Elina, and good morning on my behalf to all of you, ladies, gentlemen, dear colleagues, I would like to say. I guess I was given the tricky task for the day to keep the time and get us ready by sharp 12 so that you can start your lunch hour. It's so wonderful to be here today. As I told to someone earlier, that when I was last time in this particular room, I was taking lectures in art history, and the year was 1986 or something like that. I have been trained to be and work as a teacher in Finland and raised and trained on that campus. So University of Jyväskylä is my academic home as well. And I'm sure you didn't come to listen to me today, so I try to keep my speech very short. And I have an honor to invite our first speaker, Professor Heikki Lyytinen, with whom we have been working a while already in the international field, and I guess you already yesterday were introduced some of the achievements he has been exploring during the past years and even decades. So Heikki, welcome, and I give the floor to you to share.
So good morning. I'm so happy to be able to describe very shortly what we are doing, and I include some provocative arguments here, so I hope we can discuss. So I try to keep last 10 minutes free for discussion. So why reading is important? This is what I say, try to convince you. One of the most common reasons to compromise survival in working, also in developed. Possibly the most important single reason of poverty in underdeveloped world. Because if you are not able to learn via reading, big difficulties acquiring the skills and the knowledge you need for working. And if you are not being able to educate yourself to be able to work, you may be. You know that we have almost 1,000 million have not optimal reading skill. Of course, most of them have slightly compromised reading skills, so that the functional skill is not sufficient. They are not fluent enough for being able to comprehend what they are reading. We have also a big, big number of people who have not even the basic skill. Where I will concentrate here is to show you how we can help getting this basic skill. There are many reasons why people end up being not so good readers. In the developed world, it's biological. The reason, main source of the causes of difficulties called dyslexia. It affects in a severe sense, very small portion of. I mean, severe sense in the sense that not even the very efficient special education we have in Finland is not able to help them, about 2%. More than 10% of Finnish kids need special support. When we go to Africa, we end up finding everybody having talents first years in school. So basic reading skill means decoding, so being able to sound out the written language. Literacy means that one can really use this skill. This requires a lot of reading for becoming fluent enough, be able to remember the beginning of the sentence when one reaches the end of the sentence. This is a challenge to many. Even here in this university, we have a substantial number of students who have big problems in this issue, meaning that they are highly loaded when they are trying to learn big amounts of written material. Many of them don't know that. They don't know that they are too slow. So what we need when we are trying to learn to read is simply we have to learn to connect the spoken language, which we know, to written language. We have to be able to choose an appropriate unit from spoken language, which can be connected in a logical way to written language. And this is very simple. Consistent writing systems. All those writing systems are consistent, which are relatively new, like Finnish language. Finnish writing system is relatively new. African writing systems are so new that they are fully consistent. Because the missionaries who have built these writing systems, they have learned Latin, and Latin is written in a very consistent way. Every single letter has only one, represents only one phoneme, and every phoneme has its own letter. So consistent to both directions. In German, it's consistent to reading direction, but not quite as consistent to writing direction. But let us look English, the language I'm speaking now. None, absolutely none of the letters in English language represents one sound everywhere. Same sound everywhere. How to teach English? It's a big surprise people learn to read English. Because the first problem they have is to be able to make a segmentation of the spoken sound in such a way that this segment they separate has always the same connection in written word. And this is a real challenge. So when a Finnish person or German person, Spanish-speaking person learns to read his or her language, or African side learns to read their local languages, they need to learn about 30, mostly less than 30 connections between letters and sounds. An English child tries to learn to read English and has to learn at least 2,000 connections to be an accurate reader. So it means that this has to learn this segmentation, how to divide the written or spoken language to such units which are sufficiently consistent, like rhymes are sufficient connections, consistent, several letter sequences. So the mean number of letters one has to see before one can sound out English is 4. Finnish children, most of our kids learn to read, almost we can say most, before school age, but it's a little bit less still, but not much less. They can sound out whatever pronounceable word or non-word accurately when they have learned the letter sounds and invented how to assemble the sequence on the basis of written items, letters. Meaning is not affecting their ability to sound out. Not affecting how it sounded out. In English, it's affected very much via meaning. So morphological awareness is needed there, but not in Finnish. So why we have problems in underdeveloped world, like Africa? Most of the children there live in very multilingual environment. Like in Lusaka, in Zambia, the number of written languages, not all written, is about 70 Bantu languages, all Bantu languages. Of course, in Lusaka area, many people are During about 5 years ago, most African countries ended up to be very, very wise decision that they introduce reading skill via local languages, the languages which children know. Like Bantu languages are relatively close to each other, meaning that if one speaks the most commonly spoken Nyansa in Lusaka, he or she can understand quite a number of these Bantu languages, a little bit at least. And the writing is exactly the same. So if one learns to read Nyansa, one is able to read sound out. The basic reading skill can be learned to sound out whatever Bantu language is. But if English, not if, when English is so important, because this is the only language which is available in the sense that a lot of reading could be collected for reading, material could be collected for reading, then one needs English, of course, and this is introduced later. But teachers believe that instruction of reading of local languages could work like it works when one introduces reading of English, but it doesn't go this way. So if we just have the problems which we have when we make an optimal instruction and find out some children not being able to learn, we see that it's a speech perception which is compromised, or that one has difficulties in assembling the sounds which one has been able to store concerning each letter. One is not able to build the word on the basis of this knowledge one has. Intensive training helps practically everyone who has these problems, especially efficiently if one is facing problems in learning transparent writing. But also English can be introduced, and we have been successful in introducing training of English reading. I have no time to go into details, but those who are interested can see how our game works. It works also in mobile devices, where the first two letters and then more letters are falling down, and at the same time one hears the sound of one of them. One has to pick the letter which sound is presented to headphones, and so on. When one has learned easy selections from two or three or four, one gets more and then longer sequences in each of these balls, like two letters, three letters, so on. And how the phonemic space is differentiated, so the phonemic perception, it becomes more accurate, is described by the feedback this game gives to every teacher, parent who is following how the child is learning. So that, like in this right side picture, we have in the center the sound one has heard, and the letters there surrounding this ball are those letters which have been present as alternatives. And the most widely the distribution of this illustration shows this child to be has ended up going, the most likely it is that this player has not chosen this incorrect alternative to represent the sound here. Like in Zambia, because English is introduced, affecting everywhere, teachers are introducing ABCD, although they had to introduce ABCD. And it means that errors like shown here, so when science gets R here, and one believes it's represented by this E letter, because in English, this letter is the sound which is connected in a letter name teaching letter. And this is a big problem. We have really needed a lot of time of training for Zambian children to get rid of this problem. But especially the phonemic sound, for vowel sounds are very difficult for them to learn because teachers are introducing them in an incorrect way. And this, of course, results in big problems. One cannot learn the basic skill if one doesn't know the letter sounds. And if English instruction is used for teaching Nyansa or any Bantu language, one fails for sure. But now the world is changing. So we new technology is coming, our technology is a good example. This graphogame is a good example of how one can start helping very efficiently and very cheaply. A cheap phone can give teacher the letter sounds, as now in Zambia. And then, of course, children can also very soon get this opportunity via very cheap tablets, which we are distributing to first grade teachers. So the teachers can use this tablet for letting any child who has problems to learn the letter. Today, a sufficiently good tablet pays $50. It's about the price most of the phones they own in Lusaka, for example, families own, about $50 for has been the price of the phones. And I suppose within 2 or 3 years, many people in Zambia have these tablets. And of course, one can get a lot of reading after learning to read English, because these tablets are providing whatever in English, but very little in Zambian languages, because it has been too expensive to write for kids. None books exist for children outside school needs for reading at age when they had to start learning before 10 years of age. None. I have been going through all the publishers, and they can give none book for a child who is less than 10 years, which is exciting enough for, motivating the child to read. And this is why this new technology is needed for getting them to have a very cheap reading material. If you are interested in what we are doing, I hope you look this GraphoLearn info. Tells you what we are doing concerning this global, support we are planning to provide. And if you are interested in research, you know, we have been doing research for about 20 years of reading, and we have more than 100 international publications concerning this area, which can be invited from me via asking from my address or looking from info page. This page here. Here you can find the titles of the articles, and you can ask for a copy from this address. This is the Finnish service. In Finland, every sign has a free access to these games, which are covering not only basic English, but also math. And we have had more than 300,000 users. We have the basic principle of our approach in comparison to other attempts. We do only on the basis of scientific evidence. Everything has to be shown in scientific way and published before we start distributing whatever tools we have. Like in Zambia, when we are now starting to distribute this support, we have published that it's efficient. Finland, this publication of the efficiency of related to the efficiency of the game is brought in by and the best way to use it and let it to be used by the special educators or premium teachers. And if they accept small portion of their teaching time to go to use the game, the end results are much better. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor. Don't escape yet, because I guess there might be some questions that the audience would like to address to you immediately, or something you would like to comment or even question. If not at this point, I guess you are available during the lunchtime, and very well available by the... Please.
car. You know, the best way to identify problems of a skill in one skill is to try to train the skill. So the so-called dynamic assessment is also always the most accurate way to do it. And when this game is given to a child, we have this type of assessment track there. It's all the time providing feedback where we are and how long is the predicted time this child needs to play for reaching the goal. This is very important.
Please.
What is the number of applications in African languages that you have at present? How many languages have you developed?
We have the basic logic of our proceedings in Africa is that we are trying to train local people to make their dissertations using doctoral dissertations using this technology. So we have people in Kenya, in Tanzania, postdoc person there, very 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 well informed, in Zambia and in Namibia. Procedure goes this way that in each continent we first build one place which works like a center, like Lusaka is our center, University of Zambia in Lusaka is our center, and then we are making most requiring studies in this center place. And because the languages in each continent are somehow more, and cultures are closer to each other, it helps when we go to the next country, we need not to repeat everything. We can make it a little bit easier way in the second country and even easier in the third and so on. And now we have these four countries in each of which we try to make the efficiency studies before we continue. We have started in Zambia where we are trying to get the first grade teachers to have this tablet. We still have to make a very big experimental study where we are giving a random sample of teachers this type of tablet. It contains not only the games but also all the information teacher needs for reading instruction. And then compare similar number of teachers who have no such game. Tablet and compare at the end of this time they can use this tablet whether these two groups of kids taught by those teachers differ. And if yes, this is the most convincing way to show it because very seldom one can really make random sampling like we can do in this case, and this is an extremely convincing way to show that the intervention is efficient or not.
Please.
I'm just curious to know whether you made any research that there are thousands of languages in Africa that are unwritten.
Languages that are...
Many languages in Africa that are unwritten. Like you cannot speak in that language or write in that language. So how many languages did you make research that are written and unwritten?
Really a good question. Nobody knows the number. And of course the problem we... this type of thing, that what is the difference between two versions of the language when we start speaking about two languages instead of speaking about a dialect. But the expert linguists are saying that in Bantu areas, in Lusaka area, Bantu speakers have about 70 different types of language, Bantu languages, which have sufficient big differences that they can count them to be different. And I guess the same type of situation is everywhere there. So hundreds of languages for sure in Africa. And I don't know exactly the number of Bibles, because Bible mostly is the first written document on when we are having something written from a language. And I have not been counting how many different language-based Bibles Africa but I guess hundreds at least.
Thank you, Professor, for your presentation as well as the audience for the questions. You really were able to convince us of the importance of reading. Reading, but you also convinced us that there are means to tackle this challenge. And now I'm happy to invite and introduce our guest from Bosnia-Herzegovina, from the University of Sarajevo. Professor Susmiara will tell about the current situation in her country and tell us what is the situation with literacy of the youth in Bosnia-Herzegovina.
So, good morning, everybody. I will start with this small presentation, and you can see the situation in Bosnia and Herzegovina today. And I think I don't need to give a speech. Everything will be clear, and I will add something, and then you can ask me. So this is... our reality. It was in 2008, and today is almost the same. Where we have young people who are ready to go outside, but economic and political conditions are not very well, and they are not supporting them. So this is a map of my country. It is settled in the Balkan Peninsula and surrounded by Croatia, Serbia, and Montenegro, and we were all parts, all these republics were parts of former Yugoslavia that was destroyed during the war, and we are separated and independent states today. So these are some general overview, and Bosnia and Herzegovina, the largest ethnic groups are Bosniaks, Serbs, and Croats, and Bosniaks are mostly Muslims, Croats are mostly Catholics, and Serbs are mostly Orthodox. And this is the reason why the peers, as you can see there, can't understand each other, because political issue is very influenced in my country, and they are not allowing people to interfere. And all of three ethnicity, we all have a different history, different language, even though we can understand each other very well, we can understand. So this is short history. I wouldn't go through because we don't have enough time, but I would like to present more today. We were a kingdom. We were under the Turks or Ottoman Empire, and during the Austro-Hungarian monarchy, illiteracy, when Austro-Hungarian came to Bosnia, illiteracy was more than 97%. The reason was that we didn't have state schools. We only have confessional schools, and the Austro-Hungarian monarchy started to build first elementary schools, then gymnasiums. In that period of time, we didn't have any university or faculty at all. And later on, during the history, we changed different rulers and the kingdoms. And in before the Second World War, we had about 70% of illiterate population. And after the Second World War, the new regime, the communist regime, started to rebuild the existing schools and new schools, and they understood that only literate population can improve the situation in the country and can modernize it and can give all the same right to live and to learn. You can see some details here, and it is important to mention that the definition of illiteracy was understood differently, because after the Second World War, we were a very destroyed country, and many people, the society was agrarian, and a lot of people was illiterate, and we started to define illiteracy in the different ways, and someone could say that you are literate if you know how to read but not to write, or opposite. Today we know that the situation is different, but at that time we needed teachers, and all the time we had the lack of teachers. And at the beginning, the literate population of the country became a teacher in the same time. This was not good, but it was for the first years after we got our educated teachers. So in 1975, you can see that Bosnia and Herzegovina has 32% of illiterate population, and that was good in comparison with previous. And now, later on, we also had children out of the school because of the agrarian societies. They understood that if they send their children to the school, they will be alienated of the family, and they will stay at the cities. They wouldn't go and help their families, and they managed to organize many obstacles in order to stop their children to go to school. But that previous regime was very strong and tough, and they forced people to send their children there. Today, after the recent war, we had a war in 1991 to 1995, and the country was again very much divided, and we have these three ethnicity that can't stand together, even though common people really have good connections, communication, but politicians are those who are trying to prevent a healthy spirit in my country, and these are the reason why those young people can't get passports, can't get enough money to study abroad, and we are starting now at our faculties to give them possibilities to meet another people, another way of studying, another approaches. At our faculties, we still have the old school of teaching. We have teacher-centered education, content centers. Students are always somewhere in the second side, and the old methodology is also present, and we are trying to moderate it and to literate our students in this way as well, because literacy is not the skill how to read and write, but also how to know new technology, how to know the new IT programs and everything else. So you can see in 2001 and 2004 we had and still have the illiterate population. With 50% of them has only elementary education or even beneath, but we are doing and we are trying very hard to make situation better. So as you saw at my clip, we have students finish different study programs, but they can't get a job. This is because we have a division between labor market and programs that universities offer. So they are not balanced, and we have so many people who finished economy, who finished languages, or I don't know, psychology, and our labor market is full of such experts, but we missed vocational trainings, vocational people who can do plumbing or electricity or something. This is the problem in my country, and we now have so many universities, especially private ones, that they don't produce professionals that we really need, and the situation is bad in this moment. Those who finished, for example, psychology, biology, or other economy, especially we have so many economists and so many faculty of economy in all three ethnicity parts of country. They are trying when they see and when they come to labor market, they see that they can't get a job and they try to change their profession to get some other trainings and they mostly find a job in a low-level profession. So this is the problem that youngsters face in my country every day. We also, if adults want to improve their education or to change something in their learning and knowledge in order to satisfy labor market and their needs. We don't have enough institutions that prepare programs for adult education. When I say adult, I mean the students who finish their faculties and waited for their job for 5 or 6 years and suddenly they decided to change their interest and to adapt themselves to the market, to the labor market. And we now have 7 workers' universities and adult education centers. Before, during the former Yugoslavia, we had 56, and it was only saying that the previous regime was very aware of the need to have different interests and different professional sides of interest of doing some other things than those who we decided at first. So if adults or students who finish faculty and can satisfy the labor market decide to study something new, they are not encouraged by the government, by the law. It isn't supported by any law, so they need to finance themselves in order to change their profession. And this is something what we are doing at our Faculty of Philosophy. We have some trainings for those who finish psychology, languages. We are preparing them to be better teachers. We offer them didactics, methodics, and a lot of pedagogical issues in order to make them better teachers. And at the beginning, when they face us and see what are we doing, they are very confused because they used to teach, not to interrelate with their students or to communicate with them in a way that they should understand their needs, to have information from them. What do they want to learn? No, they were trained to be presenter of their knowledge and to teach them in just giving them theory and nothing else. So their study and teaching has not a pedagogical background. So So we have today population at the age of 25 to 35. We can see that women are in a worse position than men, and that rural areas suffered a lot of illiteracy. But we are still satisfied with the situation, even though we know that we can do better, but we need political support and support from our ministers, who are not really aware of the situation spot among the common people. And also the problem is that if we have adult education, they are studying and we are preparing them according the same curricula as in regular secondary school or faculty, so it is not adapted to them and their real needs and the needs of labor market. So we still have, we don't have this strategic status, and we are not recognized, or people who are dealing with adult and youth education after they finish a certain level of education. And I also need to point out that we don't have trust, as you have here in Finland. We don't have trust at any level in our political structure or at faculty structure. We are all separated unions, we are independent, we have universities, but each faculty is a legal unity for itself. So we can create policy as we want to do. So we need to do as it was written here, and we need to improve it, but it is not easy. So, what literacy means to me, to the students, yes, I know how to read and write, but do I know what is good for me? Is it my education job-oriented? Am I a useful member of the community? I need to know new technology to own my own computer, and you saw from the clip that it is not always possible. We need to have access to internet, and we don't have, as it is here, and our economy is still at a very low level. And we know this, I mentioned this beginning, so can we say that our youth is illiterate enough? And they could be better in all these. They are very clever, they are very hardworking people, but they steal our support and support at any level, and we are trying to give them something of this, especially we who had a chance to study abroad, and we are trying to bring them some better news, some better impulses in order to have a literated student population and youth population that can contribute to the better future of my country. Thank you.
So thank you, Professor, especially for highlighting this tight relation between education, culture, context, history, even politics in a certain area. Now there are also the microphones circulated around the audience. So if you would like to open some questions, the professor, what came to your mind when listening and seeing this impressive presentation? Please. And actually, I made the same remark, actually, when you were talking about the computer literacy, which seems to be tightly related to the traditional way of thinking,
yes,
literacy nowadays. And also, Professor Lutinen was kind of referring to the same phenomenon. Any other comments, questions? Yes.
Showed in your slides that so there is a pretty much segregation in the society. And how would you describe, however, this development of inclusive ideas and ideologies in your education systems, starting from primary to secondary level or even higher level? So is it going worse or is it going better?
It's going better for sure, because everything what European Union said should be done, we are very eager to listen and to implement. So we had a law related to inclusion, and thanks also to Finnish government and university, we had a MA project named Inclusion and Individualization in Education, and we were inclusion was introduced to us, to our country, to our politicians, and now we have inclusion. We are trying to promote inclusion in all at all level of education, and still we need support, and we also need understanding, because even some of our professors said that inclusion is a fashion, so we need to work with them. And to pray, we have trainings for teachers in order to accept inclusion, to accept children with difficulties, with special needs. Some teachers are ready to face that adventure, because it is adventure if you don't have any backup or support. They said we need to implement education, and they put it as the law regulation. But they didn't give us any instructions, any plans, any curricula. So inclusion in my country depends on goodwill of a teacher, of director, and of us who faced inclusion, who are teaching inclusion at our faculties, and who are trying to prepare our students in primary, in preschool, primary education, and those at a higher level, and we are really working hard to say that inclusion must be a major part of our education.
Training for inclusion, but would you please explain in general how is teacher training organized, and how is the school leadership regulated in Bosnia and Herzegovina?
We have teacher faculties. We call them pedagogical faculties, faculty of pedagogy, and we have a faculty of philosophy, where we prepare subject teachers for languages, history, pedagogy, psychology, and all other professions. And at Academy of Pedagogy or Faculty of Pedagogy or teacher faculty, depends in which part of country you live, we prepare preschool teachers for primary schools, and we are all in this Bologna process, and they need to have 3+2 or 4+1. If they are bachelor, they can't go into the classroom, only as an assistant to help, but we still don't recognize assistants in the teaching process. We don't have enough payments, or financial side is always very short, so assistant can be if they want to volunteer. And if you are a teacher, you need to deal yourself with this. So we have a subject special education in teachers' faculty, so they are, and also at faculty at Department of Pedagogy, so they can face the this issue of inclusion, integration, people with special needs. Is very complex question, because the situation in our country is very complex one. We have a Federation of Bosnia and Herzegovina and Republika Srpska. In Federation lives mostly Bosniaks and Croats. In Republika Srpska are Serbs. All of them have their different educational policies and different ministries. In Federation you have 10 cantons, and each canton has its own autonomy to deal with educational stuff. So many different political approaches to education, and this is the reason why we can't influence education enough, because we don't have a unified Ministry of Education. Each canton can decide who can work, what can be done, and they have the basic educational law, but they also can create their own laws in accordance with the basic one. So they can make changes and adapt the law and legal regulations related to education in accordance with the situation at the spot or with their political approaches. This is a very complex situation. I think we could solve it if there is a goodwill at the top among those politicians. So we are a very beautiful country, almost like Toscana in Italy. We have very good food, very good people, common people, but we have really bad and corrupted politicians, and they don't want us to be together.
Thank you, Professor. Thank you so much for giving these insights to Bosnia-Herzegovina and also highlighting how challenging it can be even within the European framework to develop education. First, we had the insights to continent of Africa, recently to Europe, and it's time to go to Asia. And I would like to invite the future generation professors who are doctoral students from three universities in Finland. First of all, there are Tiang Meng and Olli-Pekka Malinen. Actually, Olli-Pekka is nowadays not from the University of Jyväskylä, but you studied here.
The University of
Eastern Finland at the moment. Tiang Meng is from this campus, as well as Peter Shengyu Pan, welcome. And then from not the very north, but north still, from the University of Oulu, Ms. Päivi Ahonen. So you all are welcome, and the floor is yours.
Okay, so first a short self-introduction. So as Elise told, I'm Olli-Pekka Malinen from the University of Eastern Finland. And the reason I'm here to talk about the things related to work skills, education, Asian youth, is that I've been involved in a project where I've been studying the Chinese teachers and their perspective to inclusive education. But actually here I'm not talking about that, I'm talking about one side project that I've been working on. But later in my presentation, I'll tell you more.
And good morning, everybody. And my name is Mun. I'm originally from Shanghai, China. I have conducted my master's degree studies here in this university. I continue with my doctoral studies. And my research interest is about educational leadership in Chinese and Finnish schools. And today I will present a case study I'm conducting now. I'm going to Denver, the States, next week. Also presented this case concerning social justice leadership in the UCEA yearly convention as well.
My name is Päivi Ahonen, and I will present my research, which I'm doing for Oulu, on Bhutan. How is Bhutan concept of cross-national happiness connected to education and especially to sustainable development? So this is the research I'm going to present. Thank you.
I'm Peter. I'm originally from Taiwan, and my research is about comparing Finnish special education system with Taiwan special education system. And now, later I will point out some challenges in Taiwan we are facing.
Okay, but then to the, so we are moving here from the mainland China to Taiwan, and then take a little longer trip to the beautiful country of Bhutan. But we start with mainland China, and as I told, I've been working a little bit with gender equality in mainland China, and as a father of two daughters, I found this topic quite interesting, and I think this could have some relevance to all of your countries. So while I speak, you can also reflect what is the situation in your country in this respect. Okay, and I'm talking about the gender equality in a very particular perspective, which is the textbooks in mainland China. But some background information. Teaching material research is a one way, quite convenient, cost-effective way to try to find out what happens in the classrooms. And it has been used also in investigating gender bias in the school curriculum and the teaching practices. And I think in Chinese context, this is a particularly appropriate method because in China, the textbooks in most schools are by far the most important source of teaching. The most of the teachers, they rely heavily on the textbooks that are in accordance of the national curriculum. So by looking to the textbooks, you pretty much know what happens in the classrooms as well in Chinese context. And my presentation largely is based on this large-scale study done in 2000s, early 2000s, when 20 researchers, they went through all kinds of school textbooks and tried to find out what gender roles are to be found in those books. But I also refer to some newer research. And this is what they found. They went through all kinds of textbooks in China, used in Chinese education, and they looked for the characters, the fictional or real-life characters in different kinds of textbooks. And as you can see, they were quite stereotypical characters in those books. The girls were well-mannered, obedient, submissive. They were hard-working, but they were kind of mechanical, lacking the creativity that is required, perhaps, in the 21st century. And they were engaged in seated, role, passive, tranquil activities, didn't cause problems, but didn't make any comments either. So that was how the girl, both in the written and then the visual written and visual description of female characters in Chinese school textbooks. While the male characters, they were courageous, playful, ambitious, they were explorative, they were engaged in mathematics, science, and all kinds of scientific pursuits. So I think that may have some effect to the way that the children with different gender learn to think about themselves. And has the situation changed since the early 2000s? This is still the 2000s. And the occupations for female were teaching, nursing, service work, quite traditional or stereotypical, while the male characters were scientists, professionals, managers, workers, peasants, soldiers. May not surprise many of you. And has the situation changed? This is a study done in 2010, so it's a rather new study about the primary school mathematics book series, the whole series of mathematics books. And the males, the one point is that there were more males than females in those books, more male characters than the female characters. And as you can see, quite traditional again, wise old men were the major group of men in those books. Also mathematicians, but by far most wise old men. While majority or the biggest group of female roles was teachers, sales clerk, ticket sellers, personnel related to sports. So teachers, service professionals, and so on. And one question that is interesting to me is, does this have any relationship to the society outside the schools and outside the classrooms? And for that purpose, I found you one job ad from one Chinese webpage, a kind of recruitment webpage. And this is some kind of restaurant or hotel that looks for personnel because their business has been developing quite well, as they describe here. And in this job ad, they describe they want waitress, but they won't want any. They want female waitress. Greeter, which is the person who says hello on the door of the restaurant, it has to be female, and it has to be good-looking female in most of these kind of ads. And while the pantry helper, the person that brings the food to the kitchen, delivers the vegetables and so on, male. Safety guard, that's self-evident, it has to be male. And while the cleaning work, it cannot be done by anyone else than a female. So I would say that this sort of example says, I don't say that the school is the reason and is this the result. It can be vice versa, but I can see a clear connection in this case. And that was everything I had to say today, and I pass the microphone to Meng.
Thank you, Olivia, for the wonderful presentation from the perspective of the gender issue. And I will continue about education in China, mainland China, but from a very different perspective. And yesterday, we heard that one presenter mentioned when the South Africa was hosting the World Cup, they imported quite many Chinese skilled workers. And I heard similar stories taking place in Finland and other countries. And yesterday I also got a brochure from CIMO outside of this hall. And it says China is the country sent the most students to study in Finland as well. So for decades, yes, the Chinese government has worked a lot to improve our people's education level, and we do succeed at some point. But still, we are facing a lot of problems within our country. And one of the most topical issues now is the education for migrant workers' children. And I want to start with a proverb. It says, only those who could tolerate the bitterest among the bitter would come out as a man above men. I want to see how many Chinese students are here. Oh, quite a lot. And how many of you heard this saying from your parents and teachers? Almost all of you, and count me in as well. So, as you say, this proverb actually reveals the three ideologies behind our education system. We believe hard work pays off. So we are hardworking people and students. Education is considered as a tool to help you climb the social ladder. If you want to change your socioeconomic background, you need to go through the education path. And the third one is, if you want to be a man above men, you want to survive and thrive all kind of competition, you really need to study very, very hard. You have to be better than others. So in our education system, competition is very, very fierce. Migrant workers refer to the people who live in the rural areas as farmers, but they decided to move to economically prosperous cities to seek for a better job and a better salary. In 2011, there were 250 million migrant workers within China. This is the biggest human migration in the world, and the number is still increasing. And these migrant workers have certain features, including they do not have very high education, they do not have very high employable skills to work in the high technology field. So these workers usually come to the city and work as waiters or waitress, cleaners, babysitters, building construction workers, low pay, and do not demand very high skills. So what about their children? Their children usually have two options. They either stay in the rural areas with their little brothers and sisters, as you can see. We call these children the children left behind. Or they can come to the city with their parents. Why they want to come to the city and study in the city schools, we can see very clearly through these two pictures. In the rural schools, the class size can be one teacher with 80 to 100 students. While in the city schools, you can see the classroom is very well equipped, and the class size can be between 30 students to 50 students, and the teachers usually have at least a bachelor's degree, and now they are trying to get their master's degree as well. This figure shows the PISA 2009 result. You can see the vertical axis about students' performance in reading, and the horizontal axis shows the impact of students' socioeconomic background on their reading performance. So to the very left, it means it has a very strong impact. The students from rich family can achieve better. And to this side, it means it does not matter your family background. So we can see Shanghai achieves very high, the best performance. And also, it's above the OECD average, it's below the OECD average about the socioeconomic background, which means it is quite equal. So the students come to study in Shanghai as migrant students or local students. No matter your family background, how it is like, it does not decide your performance in school. But if we compare Shanghai to Finland and to Hong Kong and Taipei, you can see we still have a lot to do. Since Shanghai is the city which receives the most migrant workers and their children, they're also trying to improve the education and get more students into the local schools. We know Shanghai has been ranked as the number one in PISA in 2009, but it is only the Shanghai case. We cannot say the Chinese education system is the number one in the world. It's far from it. So the local Shanghai schools try to get these migrant children in and provide free 9-year compulsory education to all of them. On top of that, when these students come from poor families, the school also try to give them the free school uniforms, free lunch, and some daily allowance to help them buy the textbooks and attend the school trips. But what can these students do after 9-year compulsory education? With this very minimum level of education, they cannot find good jobs. They cannot survive in big city like Shanghai. So our government starts to provide vocational education to these students. But the problem is, what if these students want to take the academic path, want to go to the higher education in Shanghai? The policy has not supported these migrant students to study the upper secondary education in Shanghai yet. But the reform just started this year. So gradually, step by step, more migrant students could take the academic path as well. So the challenge is still for these migrant workers' children, they have problems and challenges to get used to the local culture in the big cities because it's so different. For the rural areas, they are facing losing the laborers, the young generation. There was a huge brain drain in the rural areas. There are some even ghost villages without any young people there. And quite many of these migrant students still drop out after the 9-year compulsory education because they want to get employed and get some minimum salary to support the family. The system level obstacles refer to if the students want to transfer from rural schools to city schools, they have to go through very complicated bureaucracy to do the paperwork, etc. It's very challenging to these students and parents with very low level of education as well. So a few suggestions. Here, I think we need to solve the problem at its root. So if the rural areas cannot provide good enough education to keep these students there, the government need to do is to improve the local education in these rural areas, along with the infrastructures and the social welfare system. And as we learned yesterday from the Ghana model, that the schools can cooperate with the local communities to find out what the communities need the most and what the schools can educate their children to serve the best benefits of the community. And last but not least, increase the job opportunities, not only in big cities, but also in rural areas. So these people can get good education and also get employed after graduation. So thank you very much, and this is my presentation.
Okay, let's move from mainland China to Taiwan. And there are many challenges in Taiwan, of course, but today I'm going to point out 4 challenges we are facing. It's hasty 12-year compulsory education, and the second is one idea higher education evaluation, and the third is devaluated vocational education and training, and the last one is unfriendly working environment. Taiwan is going to expand the compulsory education to 12 years from 2014. However, it's heavy in concept but light on details. For example, there is no curriculum guideline until 2016, but you know the policy of 12-year compulsory education will be implemented by 2014. So it's not well prepared and not well planned yet. And due to no well-planned education reform all the time in Taiwan, so the parents and students, they cannot trust the government. So for example, this is about a news. The hospital opened some positions for volunteers. So in the early morning, there's a long queue about 150 meters of students. They are going to apply for the volunteer, but they just go there because if you have the experience of volunteer, it makes your CV more beautiful when you apply for the university. So they are not really willing to be a volunteer, but it's just for their CV, for their qualification. And all the educational reforms, students have the right to make their voice heard. So they just have to follow the rules of game made by so-called professional adults. And even teachers are asked to be quiet, because if you fight over your rights or you fight over education or you fight for your students' right, you will be considered not neutral, and you are not a good model to students. Yeah. Because teachers, the main job of teachers is only teaching. You should not do anything political, something like that. Another challenge is one idea higher education evaluation. The first one is because the government now, they evaluate university, or the university evaluate lecturers or professors by their publication, by the number of their publication. So by the SCI, the Science Citation Index, or SSCI, Social Science Citation Index. It means more publication, you get more funding. And less publication, sometimes you will get fired. Even every student think you are a good teacher, because you, the university think you are not, you do not do research, you are not research professor. Even you are a good teacher, but because you don't have enough publication, so you are not qualified to stay in the position. And actually, most of the funding from government or business, they're allocated to only some public, because you know, Taiwan, we have public university and private university, but most of the funding, they're allocated to public university, only some public university, some best university. And students in those universities, they mainly come from the middle-class family, or they come from rich family. So it means the education resource favor the rich in Taiwan. And however, even we have the kind of situation, our government still wants to hire the tuition fee. And the third challenge is devaluated vocational education and training. And nowadays, the students in vocational high school, they study for passing the matriculation exam. It means they study, even they study in vocational college, they study in vocational school, but they study for university, not for work. And our society also devaluated blue-collar workers. And they think being an IT engineer is more valuable than being an electrician. It's a TV commercial, it means a private computer school, and it's about maybe originally you're an electrician, but after you take our courses, you get a license, you can become IT man, something like that, and it's better for your future. And last but not least, the challenge is unfriendly working environment in Taiwan. We have stagnant wages, and the wages in Taiwan show zero growth already for 10 years. Yeah. And the misery index of Taiwan is highest among four Asian dragon countries, Hong Kong, Singapore, South Korea, and Taiwan. And more unfortunately, we also have the longest working hour around the world, 2,200 hours per year, per person. Yeah, it's just like Himon said, we're hardworking people. Yeah. So, and I think our government officials and our legislators, in some way, they should blame for all the problems, because they make policies for only for their personal career or interest. Because, you know, before election, they are good guy. They give some promises, but after election, they just change completely. Okay, thank you.
Well, it's my pleasure to have this presentation after such a good feeling what the last one created. But this is a very different part of different type of country at the same part of the world. I have to tell you briefly why I came interested in Bhutan. Actually, I've been working in the region or in the countries which are close by. I was some time back 2 years in Mongolia, which is culturally fairly close to Bhutan. Then I have been working two times, one and a half year in Nepal. And Nepal is a neighboring country. And actually, I started to hear about the concept of cross-national happiness when I was working in Bhutan, in Nepal 10 years ago. So the Nepalese journalists wrote even in the local newspapers about this concept because they were interested in that. And gradually, I managed to travel to the country, which is not so easy. They have been a little bit closed, you know, it's not easy to get there. So I've been there now for four times, and I was in last July doing my interviews related to this research. So the title is Strategies of Bhutan in Implementing the Cross-National Happiness Policies. And then how is this policy applied in the context of education and especially in the context of sustainable development? So very brief history of this concept. It was initiated already in the 70s. And it was like when the Bhutan started to get somehow connected to the rest of the world, to the other countries. So they realized that they don't want to move towards only emphasizing the economic growth, like cross-national product. So as an alternative, they created this concept of cross-national happiness, which is alternative for economic growth and trying to promote, well, happiness, but well-being in general. So the guiding principle is to acknowledge the spiritual and emotional development as important as material accumulation and physical comfort. And actually, if we think of the world in general, so this is rare approach. Bhutan is one of those first countries, and world is so much connected, all the countries are so much connected to this other, so Bhutan is kind of a brave to have had this approach, even if they want to be part of the world in different connections. But one example is that they haven't become members of the WTO, World Trade Organization, because they don't want to approve all those rules and regulations which WTO has. So in 2008, Bhutan had the first elections ever. And after that, they called themselves Democratic Constitutional Monarchy. And Prime Minister Tinley is very much has been very active in promoting this concept of cross-national happiness in different contexts globally. Also, there has been a lot of interest in countries like Brazil, Canada, Thailand. The conferences have been organized around this development policy. And now, during the last 2-3 years, they have really started strongly to incorporate and include this concept into the education. So it took quite a while before it started to get to the education, but now it has started. And when I asked a representative of the university in Thimphu why it started now, so I was told that one reason was that, well, we had these elections and our prime minister is so active, telling in all the countries in all around the world that we have this concept, so we really have to do something. We can't just, you know, look what happened, but we have to become more active. International Day, maybe you have, some of you have heard that UN General Assembly announced in July that every year March 20th will be celebrated as the International Day of Happiness, and this was initiative of the Bhutan government connected to their own development philosophy. The indicators, what I'm going to tell a bit more, are connected to all levels of education, basic, vocational, and higher education. And this is a photo of one of the, I would say, good schools in Paro, the second largest city in Bhutan. The photo is aiming at illustrate that children are taking care of the environment. In general, the environment has a lot of value, not only the buildings and the surroundings of the schools, but also in general the nature. Bhutan is a very clean country. You can see clean rivers and clean forests, and even the garbage collection, we have a recycle system organized by our government that they don't have. So they are organizing it these days in a way that the children are bringing the garbage from homes to the schools, and schools is a collection base. So this is something which is being gradually developed. I wanted to mention here, in between the UN Decade for Education for Sustainable Development. We all know that this has been going on, not very high profile in Finland, I think, but it's closing 2 years, and there is still some time to work on that. But the objective of this UN Decade is creating a better world for this generation and future generation of all living beings, things on this planet. So I was discussing about this issue with the Bhutanese representatives of the academia and the ministry, and asked what is the connection of gross national happiness, and they all say it's all the same. And I've been also told that they have been participating in the conferences connected to this decade of education for sustainable development. So the Bhutanese government representatives and academic representatives have been invited into these meetings because they have had a very strong emphasis on it. So, you know, UNESCO has been interested to, and UN, to listen what has been going on. The concept includes, is structured with pillars and then some components, but here are the four pillars which are crucial. And this picture is from the school also, and the principles of this philosophy has been painted in the school. So the children are also being taught all the time what is the basic idea of this concept. And there is no such subject as school, of course, but the philosophy and principles are being part of the education system as a cross-cutting issue in all the subjects. So I think you can read them there. I don't have to repeat them. Socioeconomic development, environment, and promotion of culture and good governance. And the same way the concept can be divided into the domains, psychological well-being, standard of living, good governance, health, education, community vitality, cultural diversity, time use, and ecology. And they have done some research already in their own country about how these domains are being practiced in really different parts of the country, and how do they see the level of happiness this time. There were some two members of the Bhutanese parliament visiting Finland about a month ago, and they were telling about these research results, which I'm not going to talk now, but they are being used. They are doing this research using these domains and indicators. And the ministry is educating the teachers to use this concept as part of the curriculum. And all the teachers are being trained. And now in July, when I was visiting the country, I would say they say something like 20% had been trained, and the training plan was going on. And this is for teachers how to bring all this into the classrooms. A context, meditation and mind training. It's interesting that this is one of the elements which is introduced every class in different phases, you know, different type of meditation, first class, second class, third class. And even if it sounds a little bit far away from our culture, I just read recently from our teachers' magazine that there is something like mind training, also mindfulness training, also going on in Finland. I'm worried about the time. Minute! It's not fair. Anyhow, I will let you read this list here and see what I have. I may use 2 minutes. Vocational education. They have a different, let's say, areas which they try to develop: construction, tourism, hydropower. Also the rural area, which was discussed previously. In China, it's really an issue. They are emphasizing the vocational education, which will allow the youth to stay in the rural areas, because now the basic education is there, but then it means that the city is more attractive. So people don't want to stay in rural areas, and this is a problem. Initial conclusions. In classrooms, the teachers are saying that it has helped them to, the concept development has helped them in different ways, even improve the quality, child-centered pedagogy, discipline programs are less. And then from the sustainability point of view, the interesting discussions what I had were really emphasizing the issue, which may be quite radical even, but you know, how the sustainability is understood in different ways in eastern part of the world and the western part. And I was often reminded that the unsustainability is caused by the over-consumerism, what we have, you know, this habit what we have, which we have developed in the West. And the East, of course, tries even to change this consuming practice or habit so that the people would feel that they are happy even if they are consuming less. So I made it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for all four of you for this very eye-opening and also questions awakening presentations, and because of the time constraint, I won't allow a question now, sorry, to get us to the lunch. But as agreed with the presenters, they are happy to have this discussion immediately after and during the lunch break, because of we still need to move on in the program after. So thank you. And after having the insights into Africa, then to Europe in a certain perspective, and then from the huge Asia with those questions, we come back to Finland and this campus. And I'm happy to invite the director Jouni Välijärvi and Professor Marja-Leena Stenström to give your presentation. And you are presenting the Finnish National Institute of Research in Education with the national task, and the institute is housed by the University of Jyväskylä, so we are now back in the main campus. So Jouni, please. Let's try to make it closed by 15:15. So can we make it in 25 minutes together? So we will have 45 minutes for the lunch break. Okay. Would that be okay with everybody? Thank you.
Yep. Good morning to all of you. I think it's better to sit here, because usually I don't want to sit, because I stand to seeing you better and get better interaction, but maybe this is this case a better way. Well, I try to tell you in 15 minutes what PISA tells about Finnish education, and take also a very short global perspective, but then end to challenges, what we can see also from PISA and from other studies, what are the challenges of Finnish education system, and put that in nutshell. We can say that in Finland we can be quite satisfied what comes to cognitive outcomes of educational system. In all three domains which are typically covered in these international comparisons, reading, mathematics and science, we are doing quite well, especially in science and reading, but mathematics is also on quite high level. But the challenges are, and we can see that also from these international comparative studies, are in affective side, affective outcomes, motivational outcomes, what comes to engagement of students, what comes to self-confidence of students when they end basic education. And what I would like to stress is that maybe these outcomes are becoming more and more important when we are speaking, and world is changing, so that it stresses the importance of lifelong learning. And this seems to be the real challenge, and maybe the weakness of our systems, that basic education is not so effective to guarantee this motivational foundation, effective foundation for further studies. That's the saying it very, very, very briefly, but I will raise some issues more in detail. If you look at the PISA results from 2000-2009, we can say that Finland has been doing very well in all three domains. And what has been quite surprising in PISA is that also mathematics and science have developed very positively in Finnish educational system. Nowadays, we are in PISA almost on the same level as most Asian countries, which traditionally have been on the top on these areas. Well, we have a high equality in performances of 15-year-olds. It means that the variation between individual students is only 85% of that in OECD countries in average. But to be honest, we have to keep in mind that differences between individual students on the top, if you take, for instance, the lowest 10% and highest performing 10%, are extremely big also in Finland. It means very different skills for further studies also on cognitive side if we compare individual students, but typically we compare only countries and easily forget them. We have very clear differences in reading, in mathematics, between boys and girls. That's the real challenge. Very small differences in mathematics and science. Nowadays, girls are doing better even in science. That traditionally has been strength of boys, and most cases in other countries still is. And very clear differences in mathematical in mathematics what comes to attitudes and affective side, and that has a great impact when students decide about their further studies in upper secondary and tertiary level. How we are explaining this, well, this is something I could talk to you all day, but saying that very, very briefly, they are very similar factors, actually, what we heard from China earlier when Tian Men described the situation. The only difference is that, very clear difference, that Finnish educational system does not stress competition between individual students or between schools or competition in any way. Of course, there exists competition also in Finnish schools because I think it's created in many ways in present world. But the educational policy stresses, the educational philosophy stresses equal opportunities for all. Traditionally, it has meant infrastructure, equal infrastructure, for instance, in countryside and cities, schools built everywhere in northern and eastern part of the country, which are poorer than south and west. Nowadays, it means supporting very much and investing a lot on supporting students with learning problems. We heard this morning about research on that area, but we are developing practices also in school level, and it's a hot topic all the time in Finland, how to help students with learning problems. And that's, we speak many cases about positive discrimination, also what comes to assessment of schools, that we support individual students and individual schools which seem to have more challenging situation than on average. Then teacher education, I could speak about that a lot, but putting it in very brief, what makes difference between Finland and most other countries even today, but especially earlier, is that all teachers are trained at universities. There is a very, very high competition in applying primary teacher programs, especially. So the quality of teachers is very high. We can say that teachers are trusted professionals, and the supply of teachers is quite equal in all parts of the country. Some words about the outcomes. Here you can see how students are located in different levels in reading, in the reading skills. And typically, we define this level one and level two, some cases, but especially level one students with risk. And you can see that in Finland, the number of risk students in reading, in mathematics and science, is quite small, one of the smallest in countries participating in PISA. And this group of students is in focus all the time in Finnish educational policy. Finnish educational policy tries to do everything to decrease the number of students on this lowest level. And as you can see, countries who are doing well in on average, typically have managed to keep the number of students on this lowest level very, very small. And this seems to be the strength and way how we can move towards more equal educational systems. The other strength, very obvious strength in Finnish system, is that the variation between schools, differences between individual schools are smaller than in other countries. Typically, the between school variation has been smallest in Finland. Here I have compared Finnish schools. They are in ranked order here in Finland and other Nordic countries where this comparison is reasonable because the systems are quite similar. We can see that the strength of our system is that we have managed to raise the level of lowest performing schools quite high. And this seems to be one way how we can move towards high average, to more equal system, and also decrease competition in educational system. Here we differ very clearly from our Nordic neighbors, and when one explanation behind this is how we have organized our teacher education. We heard already in previous presentations that the impact of social background, family background on outcomes in Finland is among the smallest, but here we have to remember, keep in mind that even in Finland, if you are born in the lowest quarter in SES, if you compare the average reading the average in reading literacy in that group to the highest SES group, then the average the difference between lowest and highest quarter is more than 1 year, 1.5 year in the reading skills. So even in Finland, the impact of social background is quite strong in absolute sense, but in international comparisons, it's among the smallest. So it's telling only that social economic background still counts a lot in educational systems. Then I move to challenges, and it's not a surprise to you, but I want to remind that when we are speaking about challenges in Finland and we are worried about that 8% of students at risk, some countries, if you look at PISA results, the number of these students whom we define in Finland risk students is 80 or even more than 80%, and many other countries 60-70%. So it's telling that educational systems, the effectiveness of educational systems is extremely different in different parts of the world. And from the point of view of children, we can say that educational systems are not treating them very equally. Maybe the biggest challenge in Finland is gender issue. In reading, you can see that the number of students on low number of girls and boys in lowest levels is very different. When we are saying that among girls there are only 2-3% of students who are at risk with their reading skills when they continue to further studies or working life. Among boys, this is more than 10%, almost 13%. So this is a real issue, how we manage to develop our system more equal to boys and girls, especially in reading. There are many explaining factors. One is that reading is not such an issue in the culture of boys. They are losing their interest to read outside, especially outside the school hours. The decline here from 2000 to 2009, the number of students who are not reading among boys has been quite dramatic. And it's telling that school is more and more competing with other interests in the culture of boys. What is worrying me actually most is when we are looking at the Finnish school through the eyes of young people, it doesn't look very activating, engaging, motivating place. Here's an indicator that's telling how well teachers in mother tongue are able to stimulate, to engage students in mother tongue lessons. And as you can see, Finnish teachers don't get very high values here. And if you have time, maybe later to read these single items, we can see that Finnish lessons are not in that sense very activating or modern. If we think how they engage activities in classrooms in the world of young people, and this is really worrying me because when we think of the future of educational systems in Finland and other countries, we are competing with other sources of learning more and more. And we should also stress the importance of skills for and competencies for lifelong learning. And if we are not able to engage activities in classrooms in the world of young people, we are becoming in problems, for instance, in the behavior of students. And we have some indicators in Finland about this every day. And this is another kind of indicator that is telling that what our challenges are maybe more and more not in the system but in the classrooms and how we are able to develop pedagogies in our basic education and later. And my colleague Maria-Leena will tell more about that, what happens in upper secondary level, and especially what are the problems which are basic, maybe coming from these findings that motivational background and motivational foundations are not strong enough for further studies in upper secondary level. Maria-Leena.
Thank you, Jouni. While Maria-Leena coming down, I would like to ask you one question from this picture by myself. Is this figure related especially to mother tongue learning?
Yes, in this case. Yeah.
So it's not general concerning all the subjects?
No. I doubt that it's general. The data is coming from PISA 2009 yeah.
Thank you.
Yes, good morning, everybody. Yes, I will sit also. I think it's better. And I will concentrate on upper secondary education, especially vocational education. And here is my outline of presentation, but I will skip some of these slides. I guess you have seen many times our system, which I concentrate is ISCET level 3. You can see this general, upper secondary, and here is some direct transition from further studies or completers of ninth grade or comprehensive school in some years in Finland. And as you can see, the trend to general upper secondary education has decreased, and the trend to vocational education has increased. And we have about 9% of students who did not continue their studies. But when we look at all upper secondary enrollment patterns, the picture is different. We can see that there are 30% in general education and 70% in vocational education. And the reason is that the position of vocational education in the Finnish school system has changed in recent years, and the popularity of VET has increased so that the majority of upper secondary applicants seeks to vocational education. And we have done study concerning career pathways in vocational education and found that 72% came directly from basic education, but almost 30% students had already completed at least one qualification before studying. And the average starting age was 21. I think it's quite high. And here is some OECD. But here is how these students has graduated successful in upper secondary programs. And there is a comparison between upper secondary general programs and vocational programs. As you can see, in Finland, students who graduate from general programs has more successful in completing their studies than vocational students. Because 80% from general education has successfully graduated and 60% from vocational education. And here is from our study, and we found that that students 65% of VET students completed successfully their studies, but one problem is dropout. About a quarter of students who started in vocational dropout their study. And there are also some about 10% who prolonged studies. But some words about our VET qualification and curriculum. It takes full-time study 3 years, and it includes also on the job learning, and it includes also general core subject. And I think that these general subject give general eligibility for higher education studies. I think it's a quite unique feature in our VET school system. And, I should go to this comparison. I guess some of you know this European qualification framework. On the left side is the units of VET curriculum, and on the right side there is a EQF categories. And the Finnish FinEQVET project has developed this kind of model, but it has not yet been implemented, but this is a kind of plan for how to measure these skills, knowledge and competencies in our VET system. Maybe I will say some words of vocational skills demonstrations. They belong to the on the job learning. And they are also one innovation in our vocational education. In a vocational skills demonstrations, students can, by doing practical assignments, show how successfully they have reached the targets of VET and acquired the skills needed in working life. And we have done also research concerning this, and I think this is a very successful procedure in our VET system. And who will assess teachers, workplace, instructors and students. And this is also different from other countries. Students self-assess. And also this assessment will take place in authentic context, workplaces. And how will assess these skills demonstrations by assessment discussion, including reflection, self-assessment, and feedback. Yes, and finally, some issues concerning VET education. Comparison between countries, there is a lot of diversity, as we had heard also in this morning, curriculum and pedagogy, so on. And also assessment of skills, knowledge and competencies concerning this EQF, it's quite difficult, and how to guarantee quality assurance. And this accreditation and recognition of prior learning and education. And in Finland, for it's quite big challenge how to avoid dropouts, how to complete successful studies or upper secondary general studies.
Thank you, professors, and I'm happy, Marja-Leena, that you, till the end, brought this issue of assessment, because I now need to tell you only something that you told me, or in some conference you told us some years ago, and it was something that hit home, and I have still been quoting you all around in the world, saying that Professor Väljärvi said something that has had a huge impact in what I do, when you once said that if you don't understand the philosophy of assessment in Finland, there are no possibility to understand the Finnish education system at all. You were a bit provocative. Do you still recognize this quote of yours? Yeah. Would you like to comment on that?
Yeah. Well, it goes, in my understanding, back to the competition, what role of competition and that role of assessment. Is it comparative or is it supportive? That's my opinion. And here Finland is very different, very unique country, at least in European countries. We don't have any national testing system. Mm. We don't have any inspectorate. We have positive discrimination in local level, many cases, putting money where results are not so good where they're from. Our teachers are highly trusted.
Yes, thank you, but this is how you kind of can give you feedback that whatever we do as educators, teachers, developers in the field of education, they do have an impact, either in our home countries or globally, and I hope this can encourage all of us to continue the path we have one started, and also, as Jouni mentioned, the cohesiveness and comprehensiveness of what we do is still the key to the future and prosperity. I would like to wish you all the best on my behalf, also the organizers in organizing this and all the presenters this morning. I know you have now earned your lunch break, and I hope you to be back around 1 and at the latest 1:15 the next session will start. And there are still 2 comments, if you could just give a minute. Yes, please. Thank you. And then 2 minutes maximum to one person if you would like to contribute his research, right? There is a possibility to tell the dreams.
Okay, and I'm going to share you a tool that will a tool for inspiration and networking and teaching. It's a tool, a piece of paper. Okay, you might just think it is just a piece of paper, but for me it symbolizes dreams, it symbolizes change. So this is for all of you who are fighting a hard battle for the education for all people. What do you do in the darkest moments when you feel there's no hope? What do you do when you have spent 2,000 hours searching a subject and the minister just says no to your proposal? You go to my website. And you look for people's dreams. So on a piece of paper, I want everybody who doesn't want to leave, I want you to write a dream you have, a dream for life. So this is a dream collection database. So what do people dream of? Somebody wants to help go to Africa and build schools. Somebody wants to live a life full of real emotion and be honest to himself all the way through. Somebody wants to coach in the Paralympics as the coach. Somebody wants happiness. Somebody wants travel to Cuba. Somebody wants to see a tiger in the nature. Somebody wants to have anal sex with her boyfriend. Somebody wants to visit Machu Picchu.